Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
All the way back to 2008. Ruination, the early years.
Welcome to Ruination, the early years. I'm King, and joining me as always is my expert guide through the marvelous and, let's be honest, the often messy world of Big Fatty Online.
I'm Gail, and today we are diving into what is, I think, a truly crucial pivot point in the BFO archives.
It really is.
We're looking at the week of June 23rd through June 27th, 2008. So that's episodes 102 through 106. And this period, I mean, it's just a masterclass in controlled entropy.
Controlled entropy is the perfect way to put it. This is such a fascinating stretch of shows because Big Fatty is, he's solidifying his identity on so many different fronts at once.
And they're often contradictory fronts.
Completely. He's trying to manage the logistics of being this, you know, newly essential network host. He's also trying to be a travel expert, coordinating these big West Coast meet and greets.
And at the exact same time, he's trying to keep up this veneer of a completely normal domestic routine.
Yes. It's the ultimate collision. It's high stakes performance smashing right into low stakes chores.
Exactly. So our mission today really is to get deep into the core paradox of this specific week. It's this seamless collision of the mundane.
Like worrying about grocery sales.
Right. Or electronic billing. And Then you have the chaotic high stakes prep for his huge trip.
And then the unfiltered, almost terrifying reality of his digital brand, which, I mean, it just explodes at the end of the week with that search term report.
Oh, absolutely.
He really starts this week as a podcaster who is just broadcasting his life, you know. But by Friday, he has fully embraced this role as the conductor of chaos.
That's a great way to say it. The chaos isn't just happening to him anymore.
No.
He's directing it. He's shaping it. He's using it as this like high-octane content generator.
Yeah.
The whole tone of the week is just high energy, intensely detailed, and of course, quintessentially ruined.
Okay, so let's dive into it. We kick off the week with episode 102. That's Monday, June 23rd, 2008.
And from the very first breath, the opening phrase gives us this slight twist on the established BFO mantra. It immediately sets the stage for a week of self-definition.
That alteration is so revealing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The original saying is, it ain't over till the fat lady sings. But he takes that and he modifies it.
He says something like, it ain't over till the fat lady sings, as they say. And then he adds,
I'm fat, but I'm not a lady, and I don't mind singing. Like a triple reversal.
It is. He acknowledges the cliche, which
yeah.
Everyone knows.
Then he immediately grounds it in his own physical reality. I'm fat. Then he subverts the gender expectation. I'm not a lady. And then he just reclaims all the power by saying, I don't mind singing.
It's owning the chaos and the identity from the very, very first moment. It's a really sophisticated piece of self-deprecation that actually functions as this powerful branding statement.
Yeah, he's taking a negative cultural trope and just turning it right into a source of entertainment and affirmation, really.
And right after that really potent opening, what do we get? We get the essential domestic anchor that just pulls him immediately back down to earth.
The public's adventure.
The public's adventure. He's recounting his Sunday evening trip to the grocery store for what he calls good grocery shopping, but instantly, you know, the mundane becomes performative.
Oh, it always does. Not only is he doing this highly relatable thing, you know, grocery shopping, but he claims he was getting cruised while he was doing it.
Right. So the act of just buying coffee and bacon instantly becomes this social kind of sexualized performance.
And what it tells you, the audience, is that even his most private moments are inherently public. He sees all of his interactions through this lens of performance.
What I find really fascinating, and this really speaks to the nature of BFO content, is the almost obsessive level of detail he gives about the sale items.
It's not just a quick mention of running errands.
No, not at all. It's a full-fledged consumer report delivered with this, like, evangelical enthusiasm.
He specifically highlights the good coffee,
yeah.
Which, you know, is crucial for him to get through the coal mine work week.
Then the good ice cream, which is the reward.
And most crucially, the bacon.
The bacon, yes.
He elevates bacon from just a commodity to this like spiritual necessity.
Mm-hmm.
He says, and I think this is a direct quote, Lord Yell, when the bacon is on sale, trust me, Big Fatty is going to be happy.
that intensity, that level of specificity, the pure joy he gets from a meat sale, it just grounds him immediately in this relatable, low-stakes reality.
And it's such a sharp contrast with the digital chaos that's about to come.
Oh, completely. And speaking of being directed, the intimacy between him and the audience just gets deeper and deeper through these low-stakes consumer demands.
This week gives us a prime example. Miss Kathy's mandate.
About the Pepsi rewards points.
The Pepsi rewards points. Miss Kathy, I mean, she is the embodiment of the engaged BFO listener.
She really is. And he publicly confirms that he is now collecting these points purely because Miss Kathy has decided he must.
He doesn't treat it like a whimsical request either. Mm-hmm. He treats this directive from his audience as an absolute non-negotiable obligation.
He really emphasizes the weight of it, too.
Yeah.
He frames any kind of resistance as, like, physical danger.
He warns the listeners that they better do what Miss Kathy says because, and I'm quoting again, if you don't, she will get in her golf cart and come after you.
And that's why his audience is so loyal. He performs compliance to their specific, sometimes bizarre, demands for their entertainment. His ACT US shopping habits are being dictated by the BFO network.
It just illustrates this intense, intimate feedback loop he's built. His audience doesn't just listen to him.
No, they dictate his physical life, his consumer actions.
And he monetizes that compliance. It's a key part of the whole ruination narrative, you know, letting the audience just infiltrate every single corner of his domestic life.
Absolutely. The show's structure also, it required him to acknowledge his recent milestone, right? Episode 100.
Yeah, so he spent some time playing these congratulatory voice letters and notes from different people across the RNL ecosystem.
And one message that stands out came from Archiverture Radio. He congratulated Big Fatty, and he called himself a shut-in.
Right. That small detail, that little label, it feeds into the ongoing network lore. It establishes these different types of listeners, different types of peers.
And the shut-in listener is this very specific and highly valued demographic for him.
They're the people for whom BFO is a critical window into the outside world. He understands that.
He does. So moving into episode 103 on Tuesday, we see him briefly touch on global awareness before immediately dismissing it with his characteristic irreverence.
He notes that it's Saint-Jean-Baptiste up at Quebec.
At Quebec, yeah.
But, you know, true to the BSO style, he immediately couples that little cultural detail with an expletive.
And a guarantee that they will not find out what the F that means either.
Right. And this really addresses that point of deliberate ignorance we've talked about before. Is he genuinely ignorant? Maybe.
But he absolutely refuses to allow external culture, this non-American, non-chaotic holiday, to interrupt the flow of his self-centered narrative.
That refusal is a core part of the brand. It tells you, the listener, look, we are not here for educational enrichment. We are here for internal, personal ruin stories.
But is that ignorance really genuine, or is it just another layer of his performance? Because he then pivots so quickly from ignoring a holiday to discussing the profound emotional impact of a peer's content.
Yes, the infectious laugh of Rookie Hee from Foul Monkeys.
He notes that Rookie's laugh is so infectious that it brought Big Fatty to tears while he was listening at the coal mine, his day job.
This isn't just a quick shout out. That reference to the coal mine is it's a structural pillar of the BFO narrative.
So let's explore that a little. The coal mine is his personal source of constraint, right? Oppression, routine.
It's the absolute antithesis of the freedom and the chaos of his BFO life.
So when he talks about how Rookie's laugh literally broke through that, brought him to tears, it shows how peer content provides this essential emotional release, escapism.
The network isn't just a place for professional promotion. For him, it's a source of therapy. It's entertainment that helps him survive the constraints of his day-to-day reality.
And it shows the listener that even Big Fatty, this larger-than-life performer, needs the relief that the podcasting world provides. It validates the listener's own need for that same escapism.
Then finally, in this sort of domestic and social section, he briefly references the explicit nature of his kilt culture.
Noting his choice to wear it the traditional way.
Wait, so he really went from the sale price of bacon to unsolicited details about his kilt and inappropriate touching in the span of one segment.
He did. The whiplash is intense.
It really is.
That whiplash is the content. And he makes this explicit, very crude observation that wearing the kilt traditionally makes inappropriate touching much easier because you can just reach up there under the kilt.
And we have to remember the context of 2008 podcasting here. This level of immediate, unfiltered, slightly crude commentary on sexual behavior.
In the context of a general interest show.
Yeah, it was highly unusual. It was boundary pushing.
It absolutely confirms to the audience that no subject is too explicit or too intimate to be off limits.
Which just primes them perfectly for the absolute digital chaos he is about to unleash on Friday.
So if the bacon sale and the Pepsi points are what ground him in this predictable, relatable routine,
how does he leverage that relatability when he steps outside the mundane and starts curating his digital empire, the RNL network?
Well, the network synergy is always front and center. It's always demanding attention.
And this week had the book announcement for the new title by Holly, Walt, and Nessa,
who are, you know, foundational peers within that network. He gets an advanced copy and he dutifully posts the cover on the BFO site.
And the placement of that book cover is just a masterful piece of BFO curation. We've talked about this kind of thing before.
It is. He notes that the cover is posted right below the picture of him in a drag outfit.
And he teases more book of drag photos are coming later.
That juxtaposition is entirely deliberate. It says so much about the BFO aesthetic.
It places his peers' serious, professional, intellectual work, a book, right next to his own chaotic, gender-bending performance art.
It tells the audience that the network contains multitudes. You've got serious creative effort on one hand, and you have unapologetic ruined exhibitionism on the other. And both are presented as equally valid forms of RNL content.
He then moves on to directly promoting a peer. This time it's Larry Cly, who is a longtime friend and collaborator from way back in the Little Fatty Cast days.
This relationship is deep. It's foundational to his early podcasting identity.
And he announces the new addition to his fat favorites on the BFO site, Larry Cly's new podcast, Larry Cly Today.
And he notes that this new podcast is listed right below Kim Beaver's Lodge in his site's hierarchy.
Which provides really crucial structural context for you, the listener. Kim Beaver's Lodge is this long-standing institution.
So Big Fatty is demonstrating his loyalty to these new network ventures by placing Larry Cly prominently right beneath that established anchor.
And in episode 103, he gives his initial review of the show, kind of positioning himself as a network critic.
He said he found the two posted episodes interesting.
Which is maybe the most diplomatic yet slightly damning review you can give in the podcast world.
It really is. He also noted a specific element that initially confused him, the special background music.
Right. He said it didn't make any sense to him until it was explained to him.
And he adds that trademark self-deprecating humor, saying sometimes the old people have to have things explained to them.
This is such a standard maneuver in the BFO content strategy. He admits confusion, he gets an explanation, and then he shares that learning moment with the audience.
It reinforces the idea that they are all navigating this, you know, modern digital landscape together.
Even if some of them, like him, are the old people who need a little technological handholding, it makes him relatable, even in his ignorance.
And shifting back to his own personal logistics, he shared a very relatable piece of content, this electronic billing trial with a major credit card.
He's attempting to switch his American Express payments to electronic billing. Now, for most people, this is a boring administrative task.
But for BFO, this becomes a potential bureaucratic saga.
Exactly. He plans to monitor closely, and if it doesn't work out, he promises he will call American Express back and be pissy.
This small administrative task becomes a serialized story for the audience. His willingness to be pissy, to, you know, fight the credit card giant and its flawed technology on their behalf.
It's part of his consumer advocate brand.
It is. He's taking on the bureaucratic nightmare of electronic billing so his audience doesn't have to. He's turning a potential failure into future content gold.
The week also included a nod to the extensive interview lore surrounding Auntie Vera Charles.
A foundational character who just embodies the chaotic potential of the BFO conversational style.
Tom the Ramble Redhead did a three-part interview with Auntie Vera Charles, and BFO expressed a profound surprise that Tom was able to contain that conversation within just three episodes.
And this is where Big Fatty elevates his own skills.
Oh, absolutely. He immediately contrasts Tom's concise format with his own more expansive approach.
Noting that he himself stretched his own Auntie Vera interview over a month and a half or something like that.
That self-comparison is key.
It positions Big Fatty as the host who understands the true, expansive, chaotic conversational potential of Auntie Vera.
He's basically implying that Tom's concise, structured approach was either a feat of ruthless editing or, more likely, a missed opportunity for glorious month-long ruination.
It asserts that Big Fatty's lack of structure is paradoxically a superior form of hosting.
This section really brings us to Big Fatty, the cultural critic and consumer reporter.
And his analysis of foul foods and reality TV are, surprisingly, vital parts of defining his personality.
So episode 104, Wednesday, June 25th, featured the foul food survey.
Right. He recapped the results of the 20 most foul foods according to 75,000 people on AOL. This is a classic BFO move.
It is. He takes this mainstream low-stakes poll and just infuses it with his own definitive, passionate opinions.
And he immediately jumps into his personal vices, starting with his deep, deep hatred for mayonnaise.
Which he emphatically describes as vile, vile, vile.
This is a definitive personality trait. You really cannot be a BFO fan and enjoy mayonnaise. It's like a litmus test.
It really is. Mayonnaise aversion, or really any strong opinion on low-stakes foods, it's a blueprint for modern opinion content.
Low risk, high engagement controversy.
Exactly. Then there's his dismissal of lima beans. He referenced the common children's rhyme.
The whole lima beans, no thank you please thing.
And then he just states, no thank you, I will not be eating the lima beans.
It's this nostalgic nod, but it's coupled with a very firm adult rejection. Lima beans represent the gross imposition of childhood food mandates.
He's asserting his adult freedom by definitively rejecting them.
And finally, he confirms the number one foul food, liver.
His reaction is visceral. He repeats the word vile 5 times.
Followed by that dramatic declaration, no liver, no man, elm will shiver me timbers.
This intense, almost theatrical reaction to common, if disliked, foods becomes a source of shared humor and identity for the whole BFO community.
The sheer energy he brings to hating a food item elevates it from a simple preference to this epic narrative battle.
And then he shifts to his reality TV report, where he expressed disappointment that Willard Scott,
the guy known for celebrating centennials and anniversaries with Smuckers on national television,
that Willard Scott did not call him for his 100th episode.
That expectation is just rooted in this profound, maybe delusional sense of his own public importance.
He reached 100 episodes, so he felt he deserved national recognition, ideally involving a celebrity weatherman, a large jar of Smuckers, and a national broadcast.
It shows his craving for validation from the very mainstream culture that he usually mocks.
He then reviewed the debut of Celebrity Family Feud, which was hosted by Al Roker, who had replaced Willard Scott.
And it was on opposite the debut of the competition reality show Wipeout.
And this, of course, leads to some classic, unfiltered BFO explicit humor.
He used Wipeout to make a colon joke. He stated the title is, best when it's not taken in the context of Big Fatty's colon, because you know that's a wipeout.
Spontaneous, crude, and perfectly fitting the boundary-pushing BFO brand. No opportunity for scatological humor is ever wasted.
Ever.
So let's dive into the Southern California hoot nanny logistics. This is key for setting up his upcoming travel content pipeline.
This is where the chaos of his future meets the structure of the present.
He provided all the essential details. The date, the time, the place.
Hamburger Mary is July 12th at 3 p.m.
And naturally, he followed this logistical announcement with more explicit humor, joking that he will be on the menu at Hamburger Mary's.
And he quickly clarified that liver is definitely not, which loops right back to his foul food review.
The idea of him being on the menu is, I mean, it's a metaphorical way of saying he is the main event. He is the chaos they are coming to consume.
He understands that his audience is there to observe his life, his personality, his performance. He is the product.
The preparation for this trip immediately brings drama, which he details in episode 105 on Thursday.
He offered these intensely sarcastic thanks for the West Coast travel trauma.
He thanked California listeners and the governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, for setting the state on fire just in time for Big Fatty's arrival.
And he noted the fires were burning near San Francisco and Palm Springs.
The very locations of his planned meet and greets.
So he's framing a very serious natural disaster as a piece of personalized content. He's viewing the state of California as actively working against his travel plans.
Which dramatically raises the stakes for his upcoming trip. If the state is literally on fire, his arrival must be truly important, right?
This personalization of external catastrophe is just a hallmark of the BFO narrative style.
And now we come to our critical segment, Ruined Ruination.
This is where we highlight the structural failures, the public incompetence, and the self-corrections that ultimately define the authenticity of the BFO brand.
And this week, The focus is entirely on the promotion of Larry Klei's podcast.
This is a perfect, almost pathological example of how Big Fatty's, his overwhelming enthusiasm and his need for personal connection.
It just runs ahead of his factual precision.
And his professional obligations. He initially gave a very strong, structurally sound promotion in episode 102.
The context was solid. He announced Larry Klei's show, Larry Klei Today, and he encouraged listeners to subscribe on iTunes. He directed traffic. He endorsed the new show strongly.
That is the definition of professional courtesy within the RNL network.
It is. But just 3 days later, in episode 105, the whole promotion just collapses into confusion.
Highlighting a classic structural failure that actually generates better content than the original success ever would have, this is the correction confusion.
Big Fatty admits publicly that he doesn't know what the podcast is called anymore. He calls it LK Today, but then he corrects himself to the LK Cast or something like that.
He is publicly confused about the name and platform of a show he just strongly promoted.
The host is essentially failing at the core task of professional cross-promotion. It proves that the flow of conversation and personal information is far more important to him than network accuracy.
But the question for us is, why does the audience forgive this professional misstep? A normal podcaster would be lambasted for forgetting a peer's show title.
But he manages to redeem this failure instantaneously, just by shifting the focus to high-stakes personal gossip.
That's because the whole reason he was talking about it was news he learned from Larry Klei's show.
The Salmonella update.
Right. Klei got Salmonella from eating tomatoes at Disney World. The professional failure is instantly replaced by compelling personal horror.
And the audience cares far more about Salmonella than they do about iTunes subscriptions.
Exactly. The failure to name the show is a professional foul, no question. But the audience doesn't care because he immediately replaces that professional information with high stakes, personal horror.
A dangerous gastrointestinal crisis involving a friend and a theme park.
The insight here is that proximity to personal crisis, especially the kind involving bodily functions and gross-out content, that is the BFO currency.
Yeah.
It overrides professional obligation every single time.
He understands that his audience is drawn to the ruined narrative, not the polished one.
And he immediately uses this information for contrast. He imagines the personal catastrophe if he, with his own daily stomach problems, had regular stomach issues plus salmonella from tomatoes.
He successfully redirects the failure onto a hypothetical shared anxiety.
And it just confirms that even in error, Big Fatty finds content. The failure to correctly name the podcast is completely overshadowed by the shared anxiety over potential gastrointestinal ruin.
The personal horror outweighs the professional misstep, and the audience loves him more for his flawed, authentic promotion than they would have for a successful, polished one.
So we finish the week with episode 106, Friday, June 27th, and this is where the focus pivots intensely and dramatically to his physical self-presentation.
And the chaotic, uncontrollable reality of his digital footprint.
This segment has to be the climax of the week. It brings that collision of performance and data into such sharp relief.
The trip to the West Coast requires a physical transformation. The body itself is part of the performance.
And he details his grooming preparation for what he jokingly calls the West Coast Fire Brigade trip.
He's growing a chin strap beard, and he's careful to avoid the full goatee, which he notes aggravates the mouth.
This level of detail about facial hair logistics is unusual, but it's crucial to his persona. He's thinking about comfort, aesthetics, and how the beard will function while he's socializing and, you know, drinking beverages.
And then he adds the soul patch. And he explicitly notes the homosexual slang for it.
He calls it either the Cree catcher or the flavor saver.
We have to pause here because this is where the boundary pushing of 2008 podcasting gets radical.
Absolutely. He's using the specific language of his community, and he's normalizing explicit sexual slang within the framework of a casual grooming report.
In 2008, outside of explicitly adult content, hearing terms like sea catcher or flavor saver just casually dropped into a show that also discusses grocery shopping and credit card bills.
It was genuinely shocking, and it solidified his reputation as a completely unfiltered voice.
But his appearance strategy goes even deeper than just choosing a style. It's segmented for his different audiences.
Yeah.
This is high-level persona management.
He plans to color the currently gray beard darker for the San Francisco attendees.
And let the Palm Springs attendees see the grayer portion.
He is literally tailoring his physical performance based on his anticipation of the audience demographics in each city.
San Francisco, being perhaps more traditionally gay, friendly, and cosmopolitan, gets the darker, sharper, more curated look.
And Palm Springs, which he maybe sees as slightly older or more established, gets the more authentic, grayer portion.
It's drag-level strategic thinking applied to facial hair. It's incredible.
He then shifts from his appearance to his wallet with the $4,000 wish list.
He discusses posting a picture of an item he wishes he could afford. This is a classic move, sharing a consumption fantasy.
He says that if he had an extra $4,000, he would buy these items and hand them out to friends of the BFO. But he needs the money for the California trip to help put out the fires and drink some beverages.
He's performing a generosity fantasy. He's putting himself out there as the rich benefactor he wishes he could be.
It positions him as this generous, yet financially constrained benefactor. He's sharing the fantasy of generosity.
Which only reinforces the loyalty of the BFO friends who know his real and far more honest priorities, travel and drinking.
The fantasy of altruism is so quickly undercut by the reality of beverage consumption.
The anticipation for the San Francisco meetup also generated some San Francisco meetup gossip.
Right. He reported getting e-letters about Anthony, an attendee of the San Francisco Hoot Nanny, who evidently has quite a reputation.
That's a crucial content generator right there. Pre-trip, slightly scandalous gossip that raises the social stakes for the event.
It ensures listeners feel like they have insider knowledge about the attendees. He is creating drama before he even arrives.
But the centerpiece of this entire week, the definitive moment that establishes the show's raw, unfiltered, and deeply ruined identity.
It's the search term analytics report.
Yes. Big Fatty gets a daily report detailing the often absurd and explicit search words people use to find the Big Fatty online.
And this is where the structural integrity of his week, the logistics, the grooming, the planning, it all just collapses under the weight of his own accidental success.
He has created a monster in the digital space, and the search terms are its voice. This report reveals the unfiltered id of his audience, the chaos of the search terms.
He reads off a truly absurd and explicit selection. It blends the deeply taboo with the utterly mundane.
First, you get the explicitly sexual content. Fatty's fisting, fisted fatty, fisting chatties, National Fisting Day, online fisting.
These terms are a direct, unedited confirmation that the show's explicit content has generated a very specific, very niche, and highly explicit audience.
Regardless of whether he intended to cater to the National Fisting Day crowd.
And he treats this with the same detachment as reporting the public sale. That normalization is the genius of BFO. It's radical transparency. He is not censoring the data.
He's letting the true chaotic identity of his digital brand speak for itself.
Then you get the more specific, bizarre, and meta content that suggests this truly fragmented niche audience.
Fatty, fatty bottoms, fatty dance sex, fatty diamonds.
And the absolute non sequitur. Frank Booper knew. Who the F is Frank Burr and why is he new?
And the reference to who is Auntie Vera.
The juxtaposition of National Fisting Day with the existential mystery of Frank Booper New is a perfect psychological profile of the BFO audience.
Deeply curious, often explicitly sexual, and perpetually confused by random fragments of internal BFO lore like Auntie Vera and external digital noise like Frank Booper.
And he also got explicit drug-related searches, how to use poppers, poppers burning my nose, and popper ingestion.
He treats all of these incredibly diverse, boundary-pushing search terms, sexual fetish, drug use, bizarre names, as equally valid identifiers for his brand.
By publishing these raw, unedited analytics, he makes the audience's unfiltered, potentially embarrassing desires a core part of the show's identity.
The search report is the show's collective subconscious laid bare. He is trusting his audience with the most ruined, least curated data about his own existence.
And what happens when the chaos truly wins? The ultimate proof is the memory lane music lapse.
Right at the end. He notes that he just ran out of time. He admits there's no time to give a clue for the memory lane music.
The structure, the reliable, scheduled segment that serves as a traditional closing routine, was completely overtaken by the spontaneous, chaotic conversational details.
And most importantly, by the reading of the explicit search report. The ruination of the schedule is complete, and the listener is left knowing that the chaos is the preferred content.
So this week, Big Fatty Online executed a masterful pivot. He seamlessly integrated the most intimate, explicit, and logistical details of his life.
The chinstrap beard strategy, the 4K wishlist fantasy,
the fisting search terms,
all of it into a daily consumable structure. And it sets the stage perfectly for his West Coast travel.
The balance he strikes is just incredible. He's moving from mundane consumer complaints about American Express and mayonnaise
to detailed self-grooming strategies, and then delivering a raw, unedited list of his audience's strangest sexual obsessions.
It all becomes essential BFO lore that reinforces the core promise of the show, which is just radical, unpredictable honesty.
And what stands out most, for me, is the unprecedented transparency about his digital identity.
Big Fatty published the raw, explicit search terms that randomly brought people to his site. He made the audience's unfiltered desires and curiosity a core part of the show's identity. He allowed his own data to ruin the polite facade.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? Here's the provocative thought to mull over.
Big Fatty chose to publish his own embarrassing and explicit analytics, the ruined data. And in doing so, he fostered a deeper, more intimate connection with his audience than any polished, curated content ever could.
So the question is, how does a content creator's willingness to admit the failure of their control, to show the chaotic truth of their own data, guarantee a level of loyalty that strict professionalism just can't achieve? Does radical transparency, even if accidental, guarantee loyalty?
It's definitely something to chew on. I'm Gail.
And I'm King. Tune in next weekend for the newest episode of Ruination, The Early Years. We'll see you then.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination, The Early Years. Join us again next weekend. We'll see you then.